Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I think that we will talk about the very last book I read, PJ, and that's the part one of The Brathiest Legacy by J.S. Latshaw, and this is Threat Below.
Right.
This is a very interesting book. It touches on a lot of themes. There's some religious themes, there's some philosophical themes, but at the same time, it's kind of a YA novel, and it also has some sci-fi elements. It's genre spanning, and it covers a lot of things. But it's the Kith, which are the last remaining humans. There are 100 of them, and they're living up a mountain. And this is, you know, for them, it's called Mountaintop. It's the tallest place on Earth, and they're the last humans. And they've been there for 200 or 300 years. So they don't know really anything else, and they live a very simple life. They don't have electricity. They don't have a lot of modern conveniences. They don't have weapons at the beginning of the book, but some do appear. And even though there's only 100 of them, and they keep a strict population control of 100, they still have two classes. The Cognates, which are the kind of ruling class, they're about a third of the population, and the other two-thirds are the Veritas. So the Veritas do the physical work. And there's this inbuilt shame that when the threat below came and humanity had to run up and mountain and hide, the Veritas, the physical race, should have done better to protect them. They didn't really. While the Cognates, who are the thinking ruling class, well, they're very smart, and they've developed a way to live up the mountain, so they've done their job. But actually, it turns out the Cognates aren't really any more clever than the Veritas. Right. And the Veritas are supposed to be hunters, and they hunt things called ultra lions and ultra bears, but these are just like raccoons and small woodland animals, and they pretend they're hunting.
Okay.
And they decide...
sound like proper lads, you know?
So Adrian and Iceland, they decide eventually to go beyond this wall that's been built around the mountain. It has all these signs in all the different old languages, so, you know, all the all earthly languages saying warning, you know, Achtung and all this kind of stuff. And they go beyond the wall, and they discover the threat belows, which are essentially sort of monsters. They have some human-like qualities, but they're definitely not human, and they are monsters. And it's this...
not too many spoilers now.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not going to spoil it. I specifically decided I'm only going to talk really about the first two-fifths of the novel.
Okay.
I don't really even want to hit... I don't really want to go beyond halfway, maybe not even halfway. Because the twists and turns the book takes are so unexpected that it would just spoil it to say them. But we do touch on, like, a lot of... There's a Mount Olympus-type vibe. There's some religious stuff going on. But essentially, they meet these monsters when they go down. And that's really where I want to stop. I guess I'll just say that, you know, they're not necessarily all bad. But I want to leave it at that.
Okay.
Some of the themes in this, are a lot of morality themes are covered in terms of, like, how we treat other people and other species and things. And religion comes into it. And it was a really, really fun read. It took me by surprise. At the point where I've covered, it's a more or less simple story, and then it just turns into a whole other thing. And I'd recommend it. I'm going to read the second one, hopefully, but I'd recommend it to everyone.
Yeah, I would love to read it.
Hold on, my PJ.
Wish I could. Yeah.
Just on that note, I think I hear the phone ringing. Should we pick up and see who's on the line?
What do you mean? Yeah, sure.
Oh, welcome to Books Boys. You got Dean and PJ both on the line. Who's calling?
This is Jason Latshaw. How are you doing?
Come on. Another coincidence. This is another coincidence.
We have them every month, PJ. Jason, how are you doing? We were just talking about Threat Below.
Oh, wow. That is a coincidence. I think I just had this burning desire to give two guys I've never met before a call.
It's we and send it the telepathic waves, you know?
What are the chances, you know?
Wow, it's crazy.
So just tell us quickly just a little bit about yourself. So Threat Below is the first book you've released, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
And the sequel is already out, yeah?
Yeah, the sequel came out about a year ago. It's called A Gallery of Mothers. And
great title.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very intriguing. Wait till you
find it. Yeah, I mean,
it actually has a couple of different meanings, but there is one literal thing in the story that is a literal gallery of mothers.
Okay.
Okay, okay.
And what's next after book two?
Well, okay. So thank you for asking. I finished a short kind of magical realism novel unrelated to this series that I've kind of put aside, and I'll look at it again at some point. I'm happy with it, but... And then wrote another novel with a writing partner of mine, which is kind of pure sci-fi.
All right.
And I'm working on a standalone sci-fi novel right now that is actually... So Dean, you've read The Threat Below, right?
Yeah.
The Threat Below is kind of... Actually, I'd love to ask you a question. Where do you envision that being set? Where do you think the location of that is? Have you thought about that?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I always just assumed, especially with the beginning, you know, so it's the last humans. Obviously, there's 100 of them up a mountain. So I always just assumed it was, you know, it's Earth, but I never really thought too much about where more specifically than that, you know, what part of the planet they were on. It's just somewhere.
I would have thought the Mount Everest, and that's the most, I mean, just the highest point.
Which would make sense if these people had knowledge of the entire world. But when they're talking about the highest point in the world, they're kind of talking about the highest point of the world that they know, right?
Interesting. Like that.
It's like the Sioux, the indigenous like Sioux tribes would call the Black Hills in South Dakota the highest point in the world, because for them it was, even though they're not, you know. They're not even very high compared to other mountain ranges, right? But so in my mind, it's written, and it becomes clear in Gallery of Mothers, but in my mind, it's where I live now. It's Southern California.
Okay. Area.
And mountaintop is kind of, we have a fairly high mountain around here called Mount Baldy, which is like 10,500 foot elevation or something.
Okay,
like that.
So that's kind of where you see it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I imagine it. So the reason why I tell you that is because Gallery of Mothers kind of extends some of the action into the deserts around the mountains.
Okay.
But what books 3 and 4 are going to be looking at is what's been going on in Europe, Africa, Asia during all this time.
So it's going to expand.
There's whole continents between. So they don't really know what's going on in those other... There's whole oceans between these continents. And so the standalone sci-fi novel that I'm writing right now is actually set in what is China in that world.
Okay.
And then is setting up and introducing some of the characters and concepts that'll go into the official books 3 and 4.
So even the standalone book is within the same universe, as it were.
Yeah. It is, but it is a total standalone. Like, you don't need to read it as... You don't need to read the first two Baratheon's books to understand it. And it's more like... It's almost like looking back, people are like, oh my goodness, that was that world. It's very different.
What made you decide to set this one in China?
I think that I was very fascinated with the idea of, like, so without giving spoilers from the first book, but Dean, you know, the nature of the monsters that live below and that decimated humanity, right? let's see how I can give this without giving spoilers. So they arose in North America is how I, okay. Mm-hmm. And my thinking was that if those same kind of monsters arose in Europe, Africa, and China, they would be different than the ones that arise in North America.
Sure.
You know, for a number of different reasons. But even like, you know, a fox that lives on an island is different than a fox that lives on the mainland, right? Yeah. Even evolutionarily. But then, so anyway, when I thought about... when I was thinking through the implications of that, I thought it would be interesting to explore, you know, what would have been going on in China, how this kind of devastation and apocalypse would have played out differently in China. And in this world is, there's basically just three kingdoms over on the other continent at this point. So yeah, there are some spoilers that I'm giving here, so I don't want to give them. The world's a little bigger than it seems at the beginning of The Threat Below.
Okay, because in the threat below, it does seem like a small world, to be fair.
It is still a small world for them because they're completely mm-hmm. isolated. You know, it's like, and historically, like, you know, I think one of the interesting things is like, you know, at one point, the people who lived in Australia thought they were the only people in the world, right? The people yeah. who lived in Hawaii thought they were the only people in the world. The people who lived and there's a part of me that's almost sad sometimes that it seems like we know too much. We know everything. Like there's no undiscovered yeah. country. There's no undiscovered people. And so I like creating this world where it's kind of like, that's all reset. And these people, mm-hmm. they're the only people that survived. They're the only people that remain.
I mean, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that slightly primitive aspect to it. And I really, really enjoyed their lifestyle, actually. I don't know if this is common, but when I saw how they lived in the mountain, I thought, like, oh, I would like to live there. Like, I like that without all the modern technology, without a lot of the things that we have nowadays. I really liked it. And I thought, I would happily live here. But I think I'd rather be a Veritas than a Cognate. Because I think the Cognates, although they are, well, they're the upper class, as it were, if you kind of take it in a classes system. But they're the ones following so many silly little rules that they've made up for themselves that even the Veritas aren't always going along with. And in the end, I thought the Veritas are kind of freer. They've kept their prayer and their song and different aspects of culture. And the Cognates are very brainwashed. So I think if I would live there, I would be a Veritas. I mean, is that something that other people have said or is that an unusual take? I don't know.
First of all, I think that that's probably my bias too. So it's probably in the book, right? Mm. Because in some ways, because I feel like I more naturally am a cognate, I live in my head a little too much. Mm-hmm. And so like the fact that the Veritas kind of live a more, you know, physical experiential life, I think is appealing to me and something I try to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that the cognates are messed up, you know, they're like, they've got a very, you know, in some ways it would be a critique of religion of mine is it's like, we take this human experience and we try to really cut off a large amount of it and live within a certain, you know, intellectual or religious version of who we should be. Mm. And, you know, I'm not an atheist, but I was raised very religiously in a very tight-knit religious community, and I have a lot of, you know, critiques of the way that I was raised, you know.
Sure.
And in fact, like the whole idea of there being this like tiny little village on the top of a mountain and everyone's saying don't go outside those walls, it's very dangerous, it's very bad for you, don't go out, I think is influenced by the way that I was raised, because mm-hmm. I was told like, don't listen to that music. Don't watch that movie. Don't read that book. You know, the world is only going to tear you down. And, you know, I think that it did kind of scare me. And that comes from for sure. The cognates are the ones that kind of need to create this society so that they stay in charge too. Because there's no good reason for they're not even smarter.
You know, that's the thing. Yeah. So they say, you know, even the brightest Veritas is duller than the dullest cognate, but it's not true.
Not true. No, exactly. And that stuff isn't ever true. You know what I mean? Like, but Iceland is horrified by the fact that Adirane scored better on, you know, their intelligence exam.
Yeah.
And she can't believe it. And she refuses to believe it.
She struggles with believing anything that wasn't what was taught to her, like the indoctrination. She struggles to go beyond that. Like she does.
Even though she considers herself an independent thinker, right? Like she would, and she is stubborn. Like one of the things that I think is good about Iceland is she's not a submissive person. Like mm-hmm. she does kind of push for, you know, beyond what other people tell her, but you're right. You're absolutely right. The way she was raised is the founding, like she has a lot of lessons to learn because just foundationally she accepts everything that was told to her.
Yeah. Whereas Ad doesn't, he's a lot more, you know, he's the one that drags her beyond the wall in the beginning, I guess. He's the one that is very curious about, well, is there another way we could have arranged this society? Like this can't be the only system. And she's in shock sometimes at his rebellious thoughts. Like these things have never occurred to her sometimes, you know, and although you say, yeah, she considers herself a free thinker, she's still very stuck within, well, but this is in the code and this is like what I was taught. And she struggles to go beyond that, you know, which is, it's a really nice contrast, those two characters, but yet they're still the best of friends, you know?
Yeah. Which is, you know, for me, I had a really good time writing Iceland and Adirane's conflicts because, like, I mean, just a background for me, like, it's kind of a little indulgent. Like, I was a philosophy minor in undergrad, and like, I, you know, I was raised religiously, but I think about that all the time. So like, Iceland being an atheist, Natarani being a believer, I had a really good time kind of, because those are almost like two parts of myself. And so,
it's your inner dialogue, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is like my inner dialogue, giving them characters and giving them a chance to bump into each other. And the interesting thing, I think, is that there's Iceland and Adirani still have a lot of love and respect for each other, even as they, and that's why sometimes I think Iceland is so frustrating, because it's like, you know, she loves and respects Adirani, but she's so dismissive of the things that he says and believes that it's just, it's like hard to read. It's disrespectful. But I truly believe, like, if you're raised in a certain value and you never, a value system, and you never hear from outside of it, it's very easy to just think, you just dismiss people that try to tell you otherwise. You know, like, oh, well, that's, you know, I hear you. It's totally ridiculous what you're saying, but
So
there's like an arrogance of Iceland, but she's also, she's the daughter of the leader of the, what they, you know, the last village in the entire world. So she has a lot of, she thinks it's deserved.
Yeah. I mean, she's going to be the heir, right? She's going to be the leader of humanity, essentially. So
exactly.
And it's funny with Nicholas as well, because he's, I suppose in a way he's a good leader in terms of his principles, but he's just not the strongest leader. And he wants to kind of modernize certain things and take away the division between the classes. But then, you know, he'll still go to the front of the queue to get his water and things, you know, he's like, I'm going to go get my own water, but I'm still going to go to the front of the queue, you know?
Exactly. He's like, well, no, I'm not gonna be, you know, he doesn't want to be inconvenienced by his principles.
Yeah.
I think that there's something about Nicholas, for me, he wants to be liked, and he wants to be thought of as being a good leader more than he wants to be a good leader. Like, he doesn't want to work that hard and make the sacrifices and the difficult decisions to be a good leader, but he really desperately wants everyone to think he's a good leader. So, you know, it's interesting. I didn't do this on purpose necessarily, but kind of after the fact, after I wrote this, I realized there really aren't, like, the kids are kind of on their own in this book. Like, there really are no admirable grownups. There are no, like, admirable, there's no mentors, really.
I thought Ad's dad was pretty admirable, but apart from that, there's none.
Agree. But none that, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything. But yeah. But, you know, there's no Obi-Wan Kenobi in this book. There's no Gandalf. There's like, these kids are really on their own to try to figure this out.
A little bit, I mean, Nicholas, you're right, because although I wanted to think he was a good leader, he was an all right dad. He was kind of a crappy husband. Like, if you can't even lead within your, you know, how can you lead the whole of humanity? And he really was quite weak at that.
You know? He really was. Yeah. And he let Trenton kind of walk all over him. He allowed himself to be manipulated. Because the way that I see it is, Nicholas is he's definitely smart enough to contend with Trenton, but he just doesn't, because he just doesn't want to have to bother with it. It's just too hard. It's too difficult. And he just easily takes a back seat, even when he might even disagree with what's being said. He's like, I don't want to bother with it. It's too much.
I want to mention two things. The first is without really spoiling too much, but my saddest scene in the book is when we have two of the threat belows, but we see a lot of scenes of them as children. And there's just a mean little kid who keeps, you know, he presses the pain button all the time, the one that is only supposed to be pushed by Mr. Sean, and just causes poor pain to these creatures. And that was really sad for me, because they're so confused about their own existence. And I mean, the book does raise philosophical issues about how to treat, you know, creatures that you've created, or how to treat creatures of a different species and this kind of thing. And there's just a sad scene where actually now they're being treated really, really poorly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. And it's interesting, because, by the way, I definitely want you to read the sequel, because that character who pushes the pain button is a main character.
Oh, that surprises me. But wow, that's really intriguing now.
Yeah. And actually, you. I think you'll enjoy it. I think. And that's going to, he's a character, like, he's got some stuff going on his own too.
Okay.
So I find that very interesting. Cool.
Cool.
But yeah, that whole long sequence where it's kind of like where the threat blow came from in the first place and wrote it from the kind of the first person perspective of those two children. I had a really good time with that. I'm really happy with the way that turned out. I thought that was really interesting. You know, it's funny. I had one of the reviewers said about it that they really liked how it was it was like the first person of an intelligent creature, but clearly not human, which I thought mm-hmm. was fun. I was like, oh yeah, I could kind of see that. I was very influenced by Frankenstein when I wrote that whole section. I love Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I love, you know, because I came at it probably from the way a lot of people did, but I saw the movies and like the popular perception of Frankenstein first.
Yeah.
When I read the book, I was like, oh, like the creature is smart. And he's sensitive and he feels things and like he's not this grunting, you know, behemoth. And I really love that. And so, you know, I'm a father, I have two kids, and I do think that if you bring people into this world, you owe them so much, you know. So the way that these two children were brought into the world and then, you know, essentially abandoned, is really heartbreaking to me too. And when they, and you're exactly right, like that they had to go through pain without any context or any comfort, any explanation, a really terrible thing to have to go through. I mean, we all go through it, but maybe not as specifically as they did. So,
and then the last thing I'd like to raise is just my favorite character. I don't know if this is common or not, but my favorite character is Eva Shone, actually.
Oh yeah, so I have a hard time ranking them, but she's like definitely one. Like I love her so much, and I love her her mix of like innocence and wildness and kind of like violence and passion is just all.
I guess she's kind of the noble savage, right? Like she is a monster, but she has good principles, and she's very loyal and all this kind of stuff. So I really like her. I think she's the most compelling character. I like all the characters, but she was the one that I was like, this one I really, really love, you know. And she's like, she's gonna be there till the end helping, you know.
Yeah, I love her too. And I love her, you know, I told you, like, it's a lifelong struggle of mine now to contend with faith and religion and stuff like that. One of the things I love about Eva Shone is she has a real pure devotion, I think, you know, even though it's, you know, it's don't want to get too spoiler, but she has a very, what I think is, she has devotion for the reason why you should have devotion. It's like she has a passion for life and a passion for connecting to something larger than herself that I think is very admirable. I love her too. And again, you're going to like the sequel because there's a lot of stuff that she goes through and that she and Iceland go through. That I think you'll find to be very, very interesting. I think it's cool that you mention her because a lot of people don't mention her as a favorite, but she's absolutely one of my favorites.
Yeah, for sure.
I think from the moment she shows up until the end of the book is just where the book really hits its,
I don't
know, where it really hits its stride.
It is. You know? And that's around the time that I didn't want to give any spoilers after that moment, really.
Yeah. I think up until that point, like, you know, I think it's a good story. I think it's an intriguing story. I think you're like, what's going on? And then to me, I think from that point on, you're like, oh, this is not exactly what I thought it was, but it's definitely interesting. Like it's, you know, a lot of people have told me they have that experience of like, wow, I did not think this is the direction it was going in.
It's very different than what I was expecting as well. Yeah. And then it just keeps just snowballing into different twists and different things happening that I wasn't expecting. But PJ, before we kind of wrap up, do you have anything that you'd like to ask?
I want to ask, the cover again looks like more like a science fiction or a fantasy book. And nevertheless, I was wondering, and I'm on the outside, you haven't read it yet, but I'm just wondering, was the book cover there to misguide a bit? Because that's what it sounds like a bit, that you're trying to not, it's like people go there with an expectation and then you really saying them off course and already begins with the cover, with buying the book and expecting something else. Was that your intention or?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up the cover, because when I first released the book had a different cover, which I was happy with. I mean, I'm still happy with it. Like, but actually, hold on. Let me also.
Yeah.
So when the book was first released, it had
this completely different.
Completely
different. So you see, you have like mountaintop, you have cloudline, you have an image of a monster down below. Very, very different. And then like on the back, a picture of Iceland. Iceland. And I mean, very different than it looks now.
Yes.
You know, obviously.
It's night and day. Yeah, it's completely different.
So I'm very happy with the first one, but I would say that like given the genre that the book is in, which is YA, the cover really didn't fit. And I was getting that feedback from a whole lot of people that the cover, I mean, honestly, this cover to me, and again, I like this cover, but it also almost looks like maybe this would be like a Tolkien book or something like that.
Okay, yeah,
almost looks kind of engraved or something like that. And so I wouldn't say that it's an attempt to misdirect at all, but it is, it's interesting that you picked up on it, because it wouldn't be my first impulse. It was an attempt to like fit the genre. But I mean, Dean, you'd probably agree, like this book spans genres.
It does. Clearly, yeah.
It's not clearly in any one genre. You know, it's like, I have a hard time. It's YA, it's post-apocalyptic, it's sci-fi. It's
very philosophical, and you mentioned you'd studied philosophy, so did both me and PJ. Yeah. You know, so there's a lot of philosophical themes in it, as well as this, obviously there's little bits of romance, there's this and there's that. There's a lot of different, you know, there's some action scenes. I think it is genre spanning, and I think somehow both covers fit it, which is weird because they're both very different covers.
Yeah, and by the way, I am happy with this cover. The artist did a fantastic job, and but it is... It was not the first one. Like this, when I was writing the book, this is what I had in my head the whole time.
Yeah.
So absolutely, really good question. But in some ways, I don't even know what the cover would be for what this book is exactly. Mm-hmm. I was to be not misdirecting in some way.
Okay.
Well, can I ask you about is there a moment that really inspired you in your life to write this novel? Was it like an event or a scene? I mean, maybe several, but is there one specific that really brought this?
There is one. There's definitely one. So I used to live in Pennsylvania, in a flat part of Pennsylvania, by the way, like where there were no mountains, there were barely hills. And then I moved here to California, where I live near mountains. And I really love the mountains. I really love it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I can't get over how they make me feel. And so I go hiking just about every day. And sometimes, especially in June and May around here, there's something called June gloom, where the clouds come in from the ocean and they really make the tops of the mountains look like islands. Oh, wow. You know? Okay. So I love going hiking those times. And I love like going under the clouds, above the clouds, stuff like that, which happens pretty commonly. So I'd just go on these hikes and I'd be above the clouds and I'd think, oh, what if like I only was ever in this place and I knew that something down below those clouds had killed everyone and I was up here for safety purposes, wouldn't that be crazy? So it was really just like being up. I mean, it's literally a book I would have never written if I hadn't moved to California. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the water scarcity idea is like, you never think of water scarcity in Pennsylvania. You think about water scarcity all the time in California.
Right.
So, like, I never even thought about where water came from when I lived in Pennsylvania. And when you live in California, you really have to pay attention to water sources. Where does this creek come from? Because it might be dried up in 3 months, you know?
Is the water being poisoned by threat billows? All the usual questions, you know?
It really matters, you know? So absolutely. So it just kind of came from... Yeah, it and then just to add one more thought, Dean, I think you'll think this is interesting. When I was up on top of the mountain and there were clouds and I was like, what if there were things down there that killed me? I thought, oh, this is kind of like Mount Olympus. This is kind of like the Greeks.
Yes. You know?
But then I further thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if the Greek gods were afraid of their creations because the creations were trying to kill them? So that kind of was where this idea all...
Also an ancient Greek history student here.
Greece is like, I have to visit Greece at some point.
It's on my bucket list and has been for a long time as well.
That's the Greek mythology.
Well, look, I'm going to wrap up with the last question we ask everyone, which is a little bit off course, and I never give anyone kind of prep time for it, but it's, okay, as a writer, if there's one book that exists that you wish you had been the person to write, what would it be?
So that's interesting for one book. I would say as an author, it would probably be Lois Lowry. I don't know if you're familiar with Lois, like the Giver quartet of books that she's written. I love the way she mixes kind of the inner and the outer world. She creates these outer worlds that are, to me, really compelling. Kind of like what you were saying with like, oh, I'd like to live in Mountaintop for a while. I always feel like when I'm reading her works, I'd want to live in those places. But I feel like she captures the inner state of people even more, which I really appreciate. So, I mean, I think maybe I'd say like The Giver or that kind of quartet altogether. I think that would be my answer, but okay. I'm impressed by so many writers, to be honest with you. But if I had to choose one, I think I'd choose her. I think that her work is really compelling, and I'm really impacted by it. I mean, I grew up reading C.S. Lewis, so like if I wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, I would probably be very excited about that as well.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Another reason to go to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, we have a C.S. Lewis square with little statues of all the characters and things in Belfast.
Okay. I lived just a few streets from one of his houses, least away. Yeah. So yeah.
Really?
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I continue to be and have always been a huge C.S. Lewis fan. So like his Space trilogy. You know, and again, the way he works philosophy into his writing has always been
theology as well. Yes.
Yeah. Theology and all that. And I think C.S. Lewis was someone who truly contended with the implications of his beliefs on, like, you know, my criticism of a lot of Christians or a lot of religious people is they don't wrestle with it. You know, they just kind of accept things and don't look at the shadow or the dark side of some of their beliefs. I think C.S. Lewis did. So I appreciate that about him. Between the two of them, somewhere in between the two of them, I would love to reside for sure.
Well, I guess to wrap up, I'm going to ask you, would you like to plug your website or where we can get the book or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my books are available on Amazon, obviously, in hardcover, paperback, and audio and Kindle. Also, if you want to just like follow me on Instagram, Jason Seth Latshaw, I'm happy to send people books too. Yeah, I want people to read it. So, you know, connect with me. Love to do that. I think website I think is JS Latshaw. If you Google it, you'll find it.
We'll put a link to the site anyway in the podcast description, and we'll tag you on social media.
I should be better at that, but yeah, follow me on Instagram. I'd love to connect with you. Thank you so much, guys. It really, really
awesome. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for calling
in. And feel free to send the second one. I'd love to read the first one first, but it just sounds
awesome. I can't wait to read it. Yeah. Well, Jason, thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right. Great meeting both of you.
Bye.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Well, PJ, that was a nice, unexpected treat.
Coincidence, once again.
Jason calling in there to talk all about Threat Below, which is the first part of the Brathius legacy.
Wow,
Jason Latshaw. So I'll put a link to him in the episode. It was nice to talk to him. Thanks for calling in. We're going to take a quick ad break, and we'll be back in about 1 minute, and then we'll close off as always with our recommendations.
Ooh.
Guys, check out Newsly. That's Newsly, Newsly.me. If you go on there, you can get free access to a whole load of audio, including the Books Boys podcast. And if you use the promo Books2021, you can also get 1 month free premium subscription. So what Newsly is an audio app. You can get it for iOS and Android. It picks up web articles and reads them in a human voice. Stop scrolling, start listening. For the first time in the history of the internet, the entire web is listenable. Articles from any topics that you choose. Everything from sports to science to bitcoins, celebrity news like the Kardashians, articles, everything's all on there, as well as podcasts, including ours, from over 50 countries. So check out newsly.me.
Hi, I'm Fearful Jesuit. Well, that's my pseudonym at least. I keep my identity secret because I'm the host of a show called The Paranoid Strain, which takes a skeptical view of conspiracy theories. And some conspiracy theory fans are a tad touchy about that subject. My show is designed to help make sense of the insane ideas that seem to pop up constantly these days. Where do they come from? Why do people believe them? And how does their belief impact the rest of us? I'm inviting you to check out a very special episode we recently launched. It's a concept album about living through the year 2020 in a very conspiracy-addled United States of America, featuring a full voice cast and dozens of original songs by our show's dedicated band, the Paranoid Strain Orchestra. It's called 9116, and it's available now in all of your favorite podcast apps. Just look up The Paranoid Strain and click on the logo with the terrified eyeball.
Well, my recommendation for you all is, well, I've got so many books as always to recommend. Well, talking about Latin American literature, once again, big fan of the old Latin American literature, and I have recommended now Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian author, mm-hmm. and also Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I recommend in talking about Latin American literature, Luis Sepúlveda. Have you ever heard of him?
No, I haven't, to be honest.
So Luis Sepúlveda, I just read to the deep sadness, he passed away 2 years ago. That's very upsetting, actually. He is a beautiful author who creates very short novels, novellas, that are usually intended for children. He is an absolute master in his craft, but they're the kind of children books, like The Little Prince. They're really with beautiful illustrations, usually very short, very concise. And yeah, I mean, if you like The Little Prince and you like that short fable-esque vibe, philosophy, always philosophical, I really recommend Luis Sepúlveda. Now, Luis Sepúlveda is from Chile, a country which I think has created some master authors, including Isabel Allende, who I know you're not a fan of, but I do love her book, El Amante Japonés, The Japanese Lover, a much more recent book. Highly recommend that. And also Roberto Bolaño, who mainly lived in Barcelona, is famous as well for some dark tales. But Luis Sepúlveda is someone who just writes concise, short novels. Sadly, most of them have not been translated, which is a deep lack of cultural and literature awareness. There should be a protest about that.
But then to read them in the Spanish anyway. I mean, this month I really enjoyed reading in Spanish.
However, his famous book has been translated. It's called The Old Man Who Read Love Stories, which is not for children, but it is short. It's got a very Gabriel Garcia Marquez vibe about a man living in it's often set in Brazil, though. So this man is living kind of with tribes in Brazil, but he's not really from a tribe, and he's reading love stories, and he's reading all kinds. He reads all the classics, and it's kind of like just this man between two worlds, and there's what's romanticism. I really just remember him trying to imagine Venice and never having seen it. That was really relevant. So my recommendation are the three books I've read so far of his, which were all equally brilliant. Sorry, I read four. So the three, one of them I liked less. The Old Man Who Read Love Stories, the classic. One was also a lovely book called The Story of a Seagull and the Cat Who Taught Her to Fly. Historia de una gaviota y de un gato que le enseñó a volar. And that's a beautiful story about a pregnant seagull who gives birth in the last second and just dies because she's full of petrol oil. She accidentally fell into petrol oil kind of spillage and she died. Actually, stories are always environmental in some sense. And the cat, it's set in Hamburg in Germany, a cat just finds the egg. He's entrusted the egg by the seagull because she's just about to die and gives the egg. And the cat has to teach the new seagull chick how to fly. And it's absolutely moving and beautiful novel. And lastly, but not least, sorry, I'm giving three recommendations. I just have to, Dean, because this is an author I really
love. That's fine.
And the last one I read was I got when it came out. Actually, I paid the full money, which I don't usually do. I usually buy books that came out a lot before in the past. And that's one of the latter books. It's called Historia de un Perro Llamado Leal, a story of a dog called Loyal. And it's also about a dog who's, yeah, it's set in tribal, American tribal landscape. And he's, and humanity is cruel to him, but he tries to be loyal to humans as well. It's very moving. Highly recommend it. Luis Sepulveda, everyone.
Okay. Well, I have one recommendation and one anti-recommendation. I don't know if you'll predict where this is going, PJ, but first, my recommendation, I just have to give something good, and that's Dickens. Great Expectations. I think I recommended way back Oliver Twist in episode 4, but I don't talk enough about Dickens because he's my favorite author, and I just read all his books already. But Great Expectations is one of his shorter ones. It's very accessible. It's about Pip. He goes off. He thinks, you know, they're all poor. He's not quite an orphan, but, you know, they all have this similar poor orphan boy type stories. And off he goes, and he believes he's got great expectations. He believes that Miss Haversham or something is going to kind of provide for him. And it turns out that the person, she's just a mean old lady, and there's a twist as to who might actually be helping him out and giving him these expectations and giving him this better life that he's hoping to walk into. But it's just your usual kind of London tale. It's all the typical Dickens tropes are there. It's in my top three, along with David Copperfield and Oliver Twist. So if you think you might like that type of thing, I'd really recommend Great Expectations. My anti-recommendation, PJ, I read a play. I'm sorry, man. I read Waiting for Godot by a certain Beckett upon the recommendation joint of yourself and Alex, our mutual friend. I didn't like it. Now, you already know this. We talked about this ad nauseum, but I thought it was garbage. You know, I'm sorry.
This is possibly the greatest play of the 20th century. Being called garbage by Dean. So I don't know where this is heading.
I'm not going to dwell on it, but I just, you know, look, don't forget, we're used to reading and reviewing Shakespeare. Very elegant plays, very verbose, very long-winded. Compared to that, this all seemed very simplistic and childlike. That's all.
And let me tell you, people, I highly recommend Waiting for Godot, Waiting for God in other senses, who never comes. It's a very existentialist play about two individuals waiting for meaning and waiting for a person to arrive. And there's a reason why it's Godot, because it's obviously
God. Now, this has never happened before, PJ, where we have completely disagreed about something on the show. Like,
that's true enough. Yeah,
you really love this, and I loved it.
I really love it. It actually got me. I read it. Our mutual friend recommended it to me back when we worked together in Tokyo, and actually got me back into reading like plays in general. So I really I love it, and I'm almost vexed, I should say. Quaking in my boots.
Find this online, and you can read it in an hour. So if anyone's curious to see, you know, the play that divided the books, boys, you can get it online. You know,
next episode just never came to.
We're done. That's it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes, that could ruin it.
But I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about the plot. There is no plot. But you know, there's
going to be forgot. It's a very deep plot.
There's a bit they talk about at the start. It's not even factually accurate. So they talk at the start. There's a lot of I've written down in my notes several times nonsense and more nonsense. And this
is
nonsense.
It's an absurdist play, Dean. Well, it's mostly nonsense.
It's not absurdism if you're just doing
nothing has meaning.
It's like when these kids on social media do wacky stuff to seem wacky. They were doing absurdism for the sake of it. It didn't feel natural to me, you know? It just felt like, I better throw in some mad dialogue here because I'm meant to be absurdist. But do you know what I didn't like? Factually inaccurate. They talk about how could the four Gospels all have been written by there's discrepancies between them, and all four of them were supposed to have been there and seen Jesus. Well, that's not true. They were written afterwards. That's not even right. At no point are the people who wrote the four Gospels meant to have been there and seen Jesus crucified. That's a factual inaccuracy.
But Dean, maybe the whole point is, maybe it is supposed to be an accuracy. They're just supposed to be two lads, you know, Vladimir and Estragon, just on the Rampage, you know.
Well, maybe. I didn't see much rampaging. Guys, I don't know. Look, I'm not going to dwell on it, but that's my anti-recommendation. So there you go. And because this divided us, people are probably going to be more interested in this than anything else we've talked about on the entire show.
Yes, it's going to be. Oh my, this will be on social media. OMG, the Dean boys, the Books boys. All right, and again, I really recommend this, lads. And women, actually, Curtis, I say, lads, one thing I don't like about Beckett is that he insisted that this play be only played by men. Actually, there is a big problem, Dean, legal issues about women wanting to act in this play and having to rewrite the play. I think they had to change it to something Waiting for Godot or whatever it was.
Wow.
But actually, Beckett made a big point about women not being able to play, and I really don't understand that. I thought it didn't sound like a nice man. I can say that, but I really do love the play. I think it's such a pity. That's a big controversy right there.
Yeah, that's pointless and silly, you know. But whatever. But we've basically talked about everything. I suppose the last thing I want to do before we close with the song is just to tell everyone again: you've got all of our bonus shows, plus you get this show early, and you can get some t-shirts at patreon.com/booksboys. But also, if you just go to booksboys.com, you can get links to, you know, the show notes are on there, links to our social media, all the different places you can listen to the podcast. Plus, we're on Radio Oxen, so hello to everyone there. As I say, the Instagram and everything, there's lots of fun stuff. I post at least once a day, every single day on social media. So that's all on there. And you also get links to our music on Spotify and so a whole bunch of different projects and different things. So booksboys.com is a good portal for all the stuff that we're doing there, including the Playboys with the A-level thing. So if you've got a kid studying for A-level English Lit, all the plays that are being discussed are all on our Playboys as well. And you can get it for like £2.50 a month. So
there you go.
It's just
a bargain.
I have a special treat. I was talking to a musician, Rachel Sage. This is a very special girl who I've been a big fan of for about 13 years or so, maybe longer, maybe 15 years. And I asked, you know, if we could play one of her songs on the show, and she gave me permission to do that. So I'm gonna play. It's not really like one of her favorite like tracks or one of like the most listened on Spotify or anything like that. It's just one that hit me and that I really liked, and it's called It's So Hard from Ballads and Burlesque and Ballads or something like that the album's called, but it's the 2004 album It's So Hard by Rachel Sage, and it's a really, really lovely song. She's a really great singer, so I'm very, very pleased to be able to play it. So if the DJ would spin that record. And I should mention, because we didn't mention, but we've been joined all episode by little Alfred. There he is.
There he is, the big lad himself.
And BJ, we'll be back in about a month.
All right. See you then, everyone.
So you show what you know and give me heart to believe in the most courageous part of the pictures I would like to paint. So you show what you have to offer me. Operation almost empathy. And the dark side of yours matches mine. But it's so hard. Some light to her. Who could I become under your sun? How can I ever stand alone again and believe you to be a soulful friend when you were the worst across that line? But it's so hard, it's so hard, it's so hard to bleed for you. It's so hard, it's so hard.
of the pictures I would like to paint. So you show what you have to offer me. Aberration, almost empathy. And the dark side of your as much as mine. And the dark side of your as much as mine.
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. Ah! This episode was brought to you by our sponsor,
Is This a Holiday?
If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Max from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys. Get the show early and all of our bonus Boof Fan the Boys shows. And you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music. Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends. And come back next time for another episode of Books Boys.
Read some books!
What I recommend actually is... sorry, can we put that out there? I was going to mention. Give me no time to think. Hold on a second.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.